politically incorrect on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And hello to everybody, wherever you may be or around the world of ours. I'm here with my dear friend Richard Carson, and we have a special guest today, a man by the name of Graham Haycroft, and I'm going to hand it over straight away to Richard to introduce Graham because he knows a little bit about Graham, and I'm going to ask some questions about Graham and to Graham later. So, Richard, what can you tell us about
Graham? Well, just a touch, but I was going to observe, Mike, that word disruptor, the word disruptive, you know, the companies are disrupting other businesses and whatever else. Well, this bloke,
Isn't it?
He's a true disruptor. Now, it's not to do with technology. It's someone who goes out and does things or businesses that change the dynamics of enterprise. They get classified as a disruptor. Well, Graham Haycroft would get classified as almost a madman, I think, but a complete disruptor.
That's a bit unfair.
Because he has gone about starting an alternative union movement, which is a slightly different take on what we've always known union movements to be, and other facets of his business dealings. He's gone off on a slightly different tangent. So, Graham, if I can just start the ball rolling with a little query of when you went and started doing this, and I'm well aware if you've got a nurses' union, and I think you call yourself the Red Union or something like that, but I'll let you explain all that. But what made you start an alternative union movement?
Probably because I can. It was one of those things. I thought I retired in 2012. I previously had a sort of a labour hire business. I employed about 2,000 people on the payroll each week. It was a successful business, and I retired. That lasted 3 months. You can only do so much travelling. And I looked around for something sensible to do and thought that this would be an interesting project because it seemed to me the unions were charging twice as much as they needed. The existing traditional unions were charging about twice as much as they needed. They were clearly using that money to support the left and the Labor Party and green causes. And being a businessman, I'm not really a talker, so I hope I can get through the hour, right? But I'm, like most business people, I'm just a doer. I thought, well, if we just sit down and structure this thing from scratch, we should be able to do it. And here we are, 8 years later, 2014, we finally got it kicked off. So, you know, we've demonstrated that we can do it. So, yeah, it's been good fun, and I'm continuing.
We all know unions exist, and many of us probably have had a small association or not much at all with regards union movements. And I think Mike and I could probably concur with going and doing things rather than being told what to do. So how do you just go and start a union movement? It's a bit of a, I would have thought it was almost a closed shop, just to be using their colloquial terms.
Well, it was. That was what was so interesting about it, because I looked around and I thought, well, how do you do that? And because no one in the traditional union movement was going to come and tell me how to do it.
No.
And the interesting thing was, I don't think they know how to do it either, because the unions have just sort of been there since Federation, really. Now and again, they sort of split up, but it's always a continuation of something that was there before. So, there was no guidelines. So I thought, well, the first thing to do is sort of work out how you'd structure it, write a constitution, and I did it all from scratch, basically, just from first principles. I copied the ALP and the LNP party structures in terms of it's a branch-based. I wrote the constitution on a for a union which would be branch based and have delegate voting, so you wouldn't have every person wouldn't vote for the president, for instance. The delegates from each branch would do that. I did that deliberately because I wanted the thing run from the outside, but you know, from the not from the centre, but to have a decentralised structure. And that's one of the best ways of doing it, I found.
Now,
I've always taken the view that the unions have been the background of the Labor Party, in particular the left side of the Labor Party here in Australia. You know, we've got the so-called conservatives, who are a bit of a conglomeration of nationals and liberal party people, otherwise known as the Blues, and then you've got the Reds, who are the Labor Party. So, so how do you get away from the idea of unions not being aligned with or attached to or running the Labor Party?
Well, the ALP was started by the AWU, that's the Australian Workers Union, in, I think in 1894, at Bar Calden under the Tree of Knowledge.
Absolutely,
and,
yes.
The ALP, or the Labor Party, spelt with a U in it in those days, it was the political arm or the political wing of the union movement. There's no hiding it. The second union formed in Australia was actually the Australian Journalists Association, interestingly. And
might
so,
touch on that later, by the way.
Yes, we should do that.
Yeah, keep going.
Now, so the unions unashamedly have been supporting the Labor Party, and because they formed it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, although if you make that assumption that if you name a particular union and say they support a political party, you'll get sued for defamation. I think we've got 4 defamation suits against us at this stage. I resisted settling them because I'm looking forward to my day in court where we'll expose it all. But this so they've been living this sort of lie. But the problem that we've got with unions in this country isn't so much that they support the Labor Party, but the fact that they're allowed to, because we gave them, we the people of Australia, and under the Constitution and the laws that were passed in the Industrial Relations Act, something like 1907 or something, we gave them a monopoly. So the workers are not allowed to represent themselves. They could only be represented in the negotiations with their employer, effectively, by a union. So,
and they still have to be a member of a union, don't they?
No, that's how it was. That was the original start, and the unions had a monopoly. But all that changed, and I'm happy to talk. We should talk about that. Gough Whitlam changed it.
I was going to say, one of our former prime ministers in Australia had something to do with that change, didn't he?
Well, Gough Whitlam did initially.
That's a bit incongruous that Gough would be changing the union rules, isn't it?
Oh, he had no idea what he was doing. So he introduced 2 international labour organisation protocols, right? One was, I don't know, can't remember the numbers, but there were 2 of them, about a paragraph each. They were actually, I think they were formed in 1948, which is a great year. That's when I was born. And although I don't remember this particular thing, but the one of the first things that the International Labour Organization did was establish a couple of protocols. The first one was, in effect, every worker is entitled to join the union of his choice or her choice. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Join the union of their choice. And the second one was, every worker has the right to form their own union. So these protocols were introduced by Gough Whitlam. So you can imagine what Buddy Bob Hawke would have done in those days. It would have been a phone call. Gough, what are you bloody doing? Because the whole system, the union system in Australia, was based on the fact that in order to raise money for the ALP or raise money that could be given for political purposes, you had to be able to charge twice as much as you needed, right? Now, order to do that, the only way you can do that is you have to have a monopoly, right? So the legislation in 1907 effectively gave unions a monopoly. And, of course, a monopoly is where people – you can't have a monopoly and also have people choosing the union of their choice. And you can't have a monopoly when everyone has the right to form a new union. So that's what Gough did. Anyway, Bob Hawke obviously held sway. So it was another 38 years before it saw the light of day.
And that now, was, Graham, you've got to tell some of the people who are younger than you and I, and possibly even younger than Richard. Young Richard,
just a touch, yes.
We've got to tell them that Bob Hawke, the man you just referred to, also later became a Prime Minister of Australia. But at the time you're talking about, Was he actually the president of the Australian Council of Unions? Or
he was the secretary. The secretary of the ACTU.
So he had a long history of actually being a union man, if only in terms of its administration of the union.
He knew where the money was coming from.
Exactly.
Right? He knew where the money was. Gough would have had no bloody idea. Now, that was a thing we can confidently say that Gough had no idea about money. Those of you old enough to remember. But bloody Bob Hawke did, I tell you. And he would have gone through the bloody roof when this, this gesture politics, this is before the word was even around. But nothing happened until the Rudd government.
So how did this change sort of get promulgated and put into effect that now you can use it to your...
Well, so what happened, the Rudd government had this terrible conundrum because they wanted to get rid of the hated work choices legislation, which was Howard's... I mean, I'm a great fan of John Howard, but by crikey, he got that work choices wrong. The one area he didn't touch was the union monopoly. And he over-regulated and overcompensated and just created work for lawyers. Anyway.
Well, don't say that. Some of my friends are lawyers.
We have lawyers working for me, so I understand that.
All positive.
Yes, exactly. Now, so they were stuck with the Labor Party wanted to introduce a new bill called the Fair Work Act, which would replace work choices. But they were struck with this incredible conundrum. Well, how the hell do you do that? Take into account these two protocols, because when they're actually adopted, it has the effect of changing the constitution. This is why, by and large, I am totally opposed to this wanton adoption of international protocols for anything, because in every case it's tended to centralize power into Canberra. Whereas the founding fathers wanted it in the States. Anyway, they were stuck with this one. So how to deal with it? How they did with it was very interesting, because they wanted to maintain what looked like a monopoly, but actually get rid of it. And they worked on the basis that there was no one bright enough, because remember, Howard had gone, Costello had gone, Reith had gone at that stage. The only people in the coalition understood anything at all about industrial relations.
These were all national liberal types, blues, politics. And of course, as you've mentioned, Howard was the prime minister at the time.
Yes.
He was the work choices man, wasn't he?
Yes. And Costello started the H.R. Nicholls Society, and he really understood industrial relations, as did Peter Reith.
Yeah.
But they'd gone. And the Labor Party, because I know a bit of inside information on this, the Labor Party people knew that there was no one in the LNP, then Liberals or Nationals, that had even the vaguest knowledge of industrial relations. And they figured correctly, as it turns out, that they would be, if they wrote it in a certain way, no one in the coalition would understand it, would have any idea what's happened. So what they did, they cleverly, just to give a quick run through, they did two acts, not one. The Fair Work Act, which is the main act which governs all industrial relations stuff in Australia, and in that, unions are broadly defined, very broad. Basically, any group of people that have a common interest can call themselves a union. So there's there's no restrictions on starting new ones. So what to do with the registered unions, which were the ones supporting the Labor Party, because this was a Labor Party introducing the bill, the new legislation. So what they cleverly did, and it was brilliant, really, because it hit it. They set up a second act called the Fair Work Registered Organisations Act, or some wording like that. And in that, they set up about 550 pages, by the way, and about as many pages as the regulation, a set of rules which governed the former monopoly unions. And they were allowed to call themselves registered unions, which the name they had before, but it was voluntary. Now, what the Act says is that those unions, which we now call the registered unions, those unions are not allowed to compete with themselves. Right? So the Queensland Teachers Union, for instance, can only recruit from government teachers. And the Queensland Independent Education Union can only recruit from private school teachers. So if a private school teacher doesn't like the QIEU, he or she can't go and join the QTU. So they've created...
They're locked into their industry areas.
They're locked into their industry areas, but only in respect to themselves. Other unions, such as the red unions that I helped set up, they can compete with them. And in fact, the CFMEU have actually done some deals where they've set up unregistered unions, as have done the AWU, because they compete in different areas. They're trying to pinch members from each other.
Oh.
So they even break their own rules. But the important thing was that to the casual observer, it still looks like there's a monopoly, but there's not. And
but this is where your red union has a, what would you call it, a chink into the structure, and you can be quite aggressive from there, I suppose,
yeah,
in building your memberships.
Mm. Yes, we can compete. Now, there's some technical differences between the registered unions and the, if you like, the unregistered unions. But there's nothing a registered union can do that we can't, our red unions can't do. We do them differently. The thing that's, we're going to really get stuck into this, the registered unions have sort of the automatic right to represent anyone in a workplace, for instance, mm-hmm. whereas we have to go and get one signature of one worker. That's the difference. I mean, we're not going to take that. We're not going to take that to the High Court. Right. So the basic difference is that they have a few, they have sort of automatic right of entry, which doesn't mean they can barge into a workplace. It just means that they have the right to view all the employee records at any particular business. Mm-hmm. That's a right that should be removed. In fact, no organization should have any special bloody rights at all. But it's a battle to get this message through. And at this stage, we've sort of only got a couple of LNP people who are starting to get their head around it after eight years.
You're talking federally here.
Oh, both as federal and state.
Okay, right.
Both,
right.
Hopeless.
And the problem with that sort of an arrangement whereby somebody can just go in and obtain the records, if you like, is that it invades privacy, obviously, but it goes far further than that, doesn't it? Because somebody who might want to be a unionist but not a registered unionist or a member of a registered union may not want the people who are registered unions or people who represent them knowing what they're doing. Isn't that the situation?
Well, it is. I mean, if you're a member of our union, why should another union be able to see your time and wages records?
Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. In practice, it doesn't really matter, but it's just one of those things that you can argue about.
But I mean, are these records do with it anyway? The records of the employer?
Yeah.
Are they the records of the business that people are employed by?
Well, in the old days, the industrial inspectors or whatever the equivalent is with the Fair Work Commission now can go in and check the wages records if someone makes a complaint, I think, of being underpaid, whatever.
But that should be by individual, shouldn't it? Not be a group look.
Yeah, well, okay, let me just work through that.
Yep, thanks.
The government guys, they can go in and have a look at the stuff too, at any time, of course. But the union officials have the right to actually pretty much see all of the records in a workplace, whereas, for instance, a red union can only see the records of their members.
Right.
Or the record of their member. You know, if there's 10 members in a place where there's 20 employees.
So you have tougher, stricter guidelines of what you can do as a union versus a carte blanche of a government union structure having a look.
Yeah. Look, they gave them some special privileges, which they sound important, but they're actually not.
Okay.
So that's what and of course, everyone thinks it, and they tell the lie and said, oh, no, we're the only ones that can do that. The Labor Party people who are the beneficiaries, they say, oh, they're the only ones. And the LNP people go, oh, we'd have to read something. We don't read, as you know, so that's the end of that. So they don't do anything.
But that's an important point, though, that you're making observations there that I'd say a lot of employers wouldn't be aware of, and they would acquiesce to the labour union requirement, perhaps unnecessarily.
Well, they can. Yeah, there's a legal right to do it, but it's fairly meaningless now.
Right.
In private, I mean, in the public sector, you know, the unions, when there's a Labor government, they just let them do everything.
Mm.
But the other unions are pretty much disappearing. I mean, the red unions we were 7,000 members in total last July. We're now 17,000.
Wow.
So that's grown quite significantly. The AWU would be scratching. There'd be somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 in Queensland. Right. So we're bigger than the AWU.
Wow.
The Transport Workers Union, that's effectively in administration with their federal body. The federal body have come in and effectively taken it over. They have less than 3,000 members in Queensland. So we're seeing a huge change.
Graham, is this because people are, you know, disenchanted with having to technically take on the philosophy of the labour union when they may not have that philosophy at all? Is that where they're coming from, or what's happening here?
No, it's all about money and power.
Okay.
Dick. If you take 100
he's not
workers.
I'm going to call him Dick.
No, that's going to be trouble now. But he's the guest, though.
This is a very important statistic. You take 100 workers and say, righto, we want you to join this union, and it's going to cost you, you know, between $500 and $700 in that sort of range. How many workers do you reckon would join out of 100?
Not many.
Six.
Right.
Six is the number. It's some places you might get up to 10. You're never going to get past 10.
Right.
So when you look at places which have very high levels of union membership, there's another factor at play.
Someone else is paying?
No, someone else. It's a condition of the job generally. Nurses, for instance, every nurse in Australia believes that they have to have professional indemnity insurance. They're employees, for crying out loud. Precarious liability covers. But the unions set up brilliantly, nursing unions, and I applaud them for this great initiative. They set up APRA, which is the regulatory authority. And that's something we should talk about in a different program. But they made it effectively a condition of nurse registration that you need, or nurse registration that you need to have professional indemnity insurance, and the only place you can really get that is through your union. So we set up that facility for our nurses, so we've got it. But probably going back to the AWU, the only reason people joined the AWU was because the AWU did enterprise bargaining agreements. In fact, Bill Shorten got a mention in the Royal Commission. Got some backhanders from... It was in the Royal Commission. He forgot. He did declare it 8 years later, but he just forgot the first case.
A lot of forgetting happens in that area, isn't it? Terrible.
The way unions make their money, this is a very important thing to understand. It's very simple. First of all, you have to start with a complicated system. And there's probably nothing more complicated than the award system in Australia.
Right?
So that's your starting point. Guess who makes it complicated? Interestingly, the unions and the industry associations and HR people. They are the ones who are involved in making it complicated to start with. So this is how the unions make money. And this is certainly the case in Coles and Woolworths and those particular chains with the SDA. The unions go along and say, look, we can help you to go on to the owners, right, the business owners, and say, we can help you reduce your unit labour costs by, and one of the good ways to do that, Dick, as you know, is if you get rid of penalty rates, you quite massively simplify the employment arrangements, and it can become much more effectively, and you actually do better do for the employees. But that's beside the point. The unions had virtually the sole right to do those deals. And, of course, the deal works both ways. Okay, the unions agree to it on the condition that the employer makes it a condition of employment that the workers join their union. That's how you get from six out of 100 to 50 or 100.
Right.
That's how it happens. It's all only about money. In fact, now you've got Albanese rabbiting on about he wants to make workplaces more efficient by reintroducing, you know, changing the enterprise bargaining agreement rules. They've effectively collapsed. The moment you have competition in that field, you can't do those deals because the other union or other unions will say, that's bullshit. We're not going to agree to that. But if you can keep the competitors away, you can do these screw-down deals.
Right. So
we're going to come back. We're going to go to a short break. Yep. We're going to come back with more of this. And as after we've had the break, I've got some interesting other news, and then we can carry on with our conversation.
Sure.
Richard, off to a break.
Certainly.
You should hear what Jesse Zirawell is talking about.
I wholeheartedly stand behind that, and I've been really galled by the increasing rhetoric about how this is what's happening in Ukraine is part of the Great Reset agenda. And some people even going so far as to say that all of this is staged or phony or orchestrated. What I just read is your response to that, but maybe we can talk about that a little bit because I think it needs to be addressed and put in its place.
It's being amplified by the media discourse, of course, Western media discourse, which are eliciting sympathy for Ukrainians because they're white, they're blue-eyed, they're blonde-haired, they look like us, they dress like us. I mean, this kind of language is actually being used, which is, I mean, it's racism.
Jesse Zirawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
The bushfire was so unpredictable, it was important to have a plan.
We stayed up to date with our phones and the radio. We knew it was coming.
I never thought it would actually happen. I'm glad we had a plan.
You have to prepare your property and your family.
And there was always had a plan.
We can all be bushfire ready. Do your 5-minute bushfire plan today.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNTRadio.live.
And we're back again with Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson. Richard, just before we go back to asking some questions of Graham Haycroft, I was just interested to know that there was a chap called Adam Carter who worked for CBC News. Some years ago, he published a list of interesting songs that have been written about the union movement and so on. And of course, unionists are often many things, steadfast political people, really decent musicians, and union songs have been part of the movement since the very beginning. I suppose you agree with that, Graham. I was just going to say that one song I remember was a song called Factory by Bruce Springsteen. Another song by Florence Reece was called Which Side Are You On? You might remember some of these. Working Class Hero by John Lennon. Billy Bragg, who wrote and sang Power in a Union. Tom Morello, who wrote Union Town. Johnny Paycheck, Take This Job and Shove It. Judy Collins, Bread and Roses. Pete Seeger, Solidarity Forever. Woody Guthrie in Union Burying Ground. Greg McPherson, Company Store. And last but not least, with honourable mention, a song that came out of that cartoon series, The Simpsons, called The Power Plant Strike Song. What do you think of that for a bit of trivia? So let's go back.
I'm dumbfounded, Mike.
Let's go back to where we were, guys. What song have you got for us?
What do I? No, I don't have a song. I should have thought of something really witty to say, but I can't.
No.
I can't think of anything.
No, we don't have anything.
That's a bit hard to follow, actually, Mike. That was certainly taking us back through the realms of the 70s and 50s. Back to a bit of sense and sensibility, I think, now, where on the trail of the money.
Keep to the money.
Which it interests me how it all, A, comes, and then B, flows away from the I would have thought, the right recipients, namely the workers.
Yep.
And it is then taken away over in an overpriced agreement for the benefit of the Labor Party. So would that be a big selling point or a big issue in your getting so many more members so quickly?
Oh, we're half price, you see.
You're half price.
Yeah. Right. See, we just use the Queensland Nurses as an example. The Queensland Nurses and Midwifery Union charged $717.50 for a full-time membership, right? Whereas our Nurses Professional Association of Queensland, I'll call it NPAQ, charges like 442, I think, is the number. Mm-hmm. What's that, $270 difference?
$272
difference. About 60%, really.
Yeah.
That's probably not really a fair comparison. It's more, the fairer one is to take the, have a look at the annual accounts of the Nurses Union and of the Teachers Union. And just take an average. So you take the total cost for the nurses, you take a total cost of what it costs to provide the services according to their accounts, you know, which is something like 32 or 33 million, and you divide into what they say are their number of members. And you do that sum, you can end up with something like, I think there was $516 or something was the amount of money. And you do the same exercise with the teachers. Interesting, you get around about the $500 mark. Whereas the average cost, because we've all got sort of part-timers and we've got students and they distort the numbers down a bit. Our average collect, if you like, on members is just over $300. Right? So there's a lot of part-timers and stuff involved. They're the real ones. So you take 516 minus 315, it's about $200 per every member difference. So the question to ask is, what happens to that $200, Dick?
I was going to ask you that question, right?
Well, we don't know what happens to that $200 other than it comes out of the pockets of the nurses and the teachers and gets redirected somewhere that where they would much rather redirect themselves in, if they had it in their pockets to keep.
Perhaps towards a political party.
Of course it is. And it's not, and they don't actually donate money. I think the QNMU and the Teachers Union donated about $100,000 each, which is about $1.50 a member, to the Queensland Council of Unions. I mean, this is just pin money. It's the $200 that's the important stuff.
Hmm.
Now, what they do, they're currently running advertising campaign, both teachers and nurses, are running campaign ads on TV and radio against the Morrison government. Now, that won't show down. That will just be absorbed in marketing costs in their accounts. And their auditors don't have to report it. They're not doing anything illegal. But that's how they've got this huge berry of, you know, $200 per member per year.
It's about 12 million, I think.
I think the sum is, I did the numbers where you've got
12,400,000 that adds up to.
Where you've got
roughly on those numbers you just expressed.
You've got 67,000 nurses, and I think there's nearly 46,000 or 47,000 teachers. So the actual sum is about 22.5 million.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So every year there's $22.5 million that's
being garnered.
What's been garnered, it's not needed. And until we came along, they could always say, oh, no, this is what it really costs. Well, I can tell you after 8 years, it doesn't bloody well cost that much. It costs bloody 60% of it.
Exactly.
You can provide the service. Go Australia-wide. 400,000 nurses, 400,000 teachers. We're talking $160 million.
Just gathered,
and, well, what happens to that?
I'd almost call it stolen.
So tell me, Graham, what's really the consequence of, for example, nurses and teachers having a genuine choice of representation rather than being coerced or cajoled into
or forced
the old school of union? where all that money comes from.
Well, I mean, we've set it up as Jack Maguire and I run a business which provides services to the unions we've set up. Look, this will lead to huge change in health and education. Uh-huh. Now, every nurse, this is the bottom line here.
That's right.
Every nurse in Queensland has their own dedicated bureaucrat. That's a little bit of colour. What I mean is there's 40,000 nurses with Queensland Health. There's about 110,000 employees. We think there's around about 20,000 doctors and wardsmen and people that, touch patients, deliver food, da, da, da. You've got around about 40,000 people who are, wait for it, bureaucrats. Nurses spend most of their time filling out forms, or they're on computer machines now, collecting data. Teachers, identical. Teachers spend half their bloody time because it's the same proportion of bureaucrats. Now, one of the interesting things, take education. There's been a very successful movement worldwide for charter and independent schools. In fact, it was even fiddled with in Queensland. Of course, the unions hate that. But the only way you're going to get rid of the bureaucrats, never listen to a bloody LNP politician that says, oh, we'll change that. Bullshit. They wouldn't know where to start.
Well, I was going to ask you, do any politicians actually understand it?
No, they don't understand it. They wouldn't have a clue how to fix it anyway because none of them have been in business. No, but
probably haven't even been to school.
The bigger problem is they've been to too much school, I think. Mike. The independent schools and charter schools, see, you don't need a bureaucracy because the parents decide which school they're going to send their kids to. See, I'm totally in favour of this national curriculum for the 5 or 10% of parents who want their kids to learn that crap. But the other 95% or 90% of parents want their kids taught sensible stuff, right? Well, don't fiddle with the bloody a national curriculum. It's a waste of time. Let any school that wants to have it. More importantly, what we need to do is let the schools determine their own curriculum and the parents then decide, which school to send their kids to.
But, Graham, you're sort of talking about freedom of choice here.
It's, yeah, frightening, isn't it?
It's but there's a bit of a worry.
There's a big buck in it.
Yeah, I've got the numbers.
The numbers, you see, you can seriously say, you can pay teachers probably 25% more because an independent school doesn't need, if there's 100 teachers, it doesn't need 100 bureaucrats. It'd probably get by with about 10 or 15. Right.
Yeah.
And you've got all that extra money and you've got to fund the user, you've got to fund the students, like the voucher system. And do the same with hospitals. You can pay nurses 20-25% more.
Now, but you're talking
get rid of the bureaucracy.
But you're talking out of sense here. Now, how do we take this obvious errors that are, burdening the nation down? And you've just said that the LNP, who might choose to be a positive influence on it, they haven't got a clue how to do it. So it's going to be incumbent on someone like yourself that has a well-grounded understanding to try to help these people start to do something positive for a lot of people.
Yes, well, I don't think it's very hard to build a cohort of the people involved. So you've got teachers they've become very left-wing because conservative kids don't go into teaching because they can see there's no future for them. But there's probably 15-20% that would be sort of conservative. You only need 10% of the teachers and 90% of the parents.
Right.
Will always beat 90% of the teachers plus 10% of parents.
Right.
That's just ABC numbers. The LNP can't count, so they can't figure that one out. And there is parents want independent and charter schools. They want the kids to learn sensible stuff. And you do the same with hospitals. It's possible, and we're getting the feedback now, we're going to build a cohort of nurses that want to be involved in a sensible decentralized system where you fund the users, like Medicare, you fund the user, you don't send the money to the bloody hospital. That's the last thing to do. The money's got to follow the patients. And again, you don't need 40,000 bureaucrats with a decentralized system. I'll tell you what, one of my ideas is you organize all these independent hospitals and you have the nurses at each hospital vote two nurses onto the board, the local board. Probably don't need to do much more than that, actually. Nurses are pretty practical people. So I'd happy to have any number of nurses on my boards.
Yeah, well, they do an awful lot and they work hard.
But they're not allowed to because there are a lot of bureaucrats who make them sign forms every minute of the day. Isn't that right, Graham?
Well, that's right, yeah. I'm talking about where this is going to go. I mean, this is... if you want to, you can talk about change, but at the end of the day, someone's got to bloody do something.
That's
what we're doing. We're doing it because the politicians will never lead. I don't care what you say. They are not leaders. They're followers. So someone else has got to do it. Then they can go, oh, it could be votes here. I think that's a great idea. I'll push it.
But just on that very point, you know, you've been going now for 8 years and you're getting a bit of traction by the sounds of it now. I always use a bushfire analogy. You have a small fire and then 3 days later you've got 50,000 acres all burnt out. You can suddenly go from your beachhead at the moment and obviously scale up fairly quickly as people understand who you are, what you're doing. Would that be a fair observation of where you're at the moment?
Oh, we're working. Because the Labor Party is in... beside themselves. You know, there's the Palaszczuk government commissioned a...
That's a new word. We haven't heard that word before. You're talking about Miss Palaszczuk.
Miss Palaszczuk. It's actually, I was married to a Polish lady.
It is true.
My first marriage. The spelling would be more Palaszczuk, but, she can call herself what she likes. They've commissioned a report and they got two former QNMU people and, of course, the Grace, the minister. And she worked for the QNMU when she was served out of Parliament for three years when Campbell Newman was there. She lost the seat. So for 3 years she was working in head office at the QNMU. I can tell you what, there wouldn't have been one nurse in Queensland that knew that. But two other people, former executives of the QNMU were involved in this report, and they want to introduce some changes which will effectively, they can't get rid of us, but they want to make it hard, and they're very clever, and they'll make it look like that we can't ever be a registered union. Well, we'd never want to be, for crying out loud. So they are trying to legislate us out of business, and make no bones about it, if Elbow gets in, the first thing they will do, they have to remove the competition to the existing unions. Otherwise, the whole money tree just falls over. So they know about us. They know.
Oh, right. So
do you think that little man who's had a haircut and lost a bit of weight is smarter than he looks?
Who's that?
Weren't you referring to a chap called Albanese?
Oh, each way elbow. Oh, look, the union movement knows that we are an existential threat to them. Right. And there's just what's so frustrating is you've got Canavan's been good, Stoker's been good, although she's tied in with being a assistant minister. And who else? Stoker mentioned, Canavan, what's his name?
Rennick,
yeah. Fabulous. But at state level, the only one that's prepared to poke the bear, because that's the term they all use, has been Jared Blay, and he's actually started to come out. But you must understand that these people are absolutely terrified of the existing union movement. They're terrified of 300 to 400 people turning up in their electorate month or 2 months before the next election. They're terrified of that.
And, of course, those 300 or 400 would be supported by this quantum of money that's sloshing around in the background. So that's how they can just branch out and put a whole lot of people into a particular electorate to make a pest of themselves.
And the good thing about, you know, fear is that you don't have to do very much of it. You know, if there's 50 politicians, you've only really got to threaten half a dozen, and you've only got to do it for two or three. So we're talking about $1.5 million. It's going to probably cost $500,000 to do that. It's probably $1.5 million. That's a mere bagatelle to the unions, and they're all terrified.
But that's
the reality. And if you get them, you line them, you know, quietly, they'll tell you they're terrified.
Why haven't they got any gumption or intelligence to articulate a point of view?
He's talking about politicians, Richard.
Oh, am I mistaken? I thought they might have had a neuron or two left.
No, even worse than that. Most of them justify their cowardice and they rationalise it. It's saying, oh, they're just being, it's realistic. Realistic is the sort of terms they
doesn't
use.
Doesn't sound too realistic to me if 100-odd thousand people are being ripped off to the tune of $200 a head each year. I would have thought they might like to know about it and do something to move the situation.
And it's all being used against them. That's the other thing that's fascinating. They are the target for the money. And so every member that leaves a traditional registered union and joins one of our red unions, that's $200 per year that doesn't get used against the LNP politicians. But it just, see, they can't count. They can't count.
I've only been listening to you for about 50 minutes and I've got a pretty fair grasp of what the hell's going wrong. I would have thought it wasn't that hard for a few politicians to sit there, take your information and then start talking to the points.
I would have thought that. There's a I'm not quite sure the problem. I suspect the problem is that their advisors just aren't up to it. I just think they're just not up to it. And they don't understand. I mean, I really admire the Labor Party advisors. Gee whiz, they know their stuff. They have totally won this COVID issue. I mean, Palaszczuk convinced all Queensland that she was going to look after them. The LNP remained silent for the whole lot because the Labor Party worked out that the constituencies who were being really hit by this COVID stuff and the mandates were conservatives. You know, your faith-based people, special rules for churches and what have you.
You mentioned Ms. Palaszczuk again, looking after us. She's at the Blues Festival this weekend at Easter, which is south of the Queensland border in New South Wales at Byron Bay. And for those of us who are not familiar with the area for a start, Byron Bay is regarded as a top tourist place in Australia on the east coast. And a lot of Americans love to go to Byron Bay, particularly those who surf. But Miss Palaszczuk's there sapping it up for the Blues Fest this weekend at Easter. First time for a few years they've been able to have it. And I'm wondering whether she's not there looking for a new song, new union song.
There'd be one there. I hope she doesn't run into some of those unusual cigarettes they have down there.
She's got some very nice denim shorts to match all the
I saw that. Yeah. I did see the denim.
All the bluegrass singers.
The bluegrass is all there. A bit of, well, it matches your surname, Tennessee. It's all happening.
From East Tennessee.
No. Look at that. A little glass of wine there. Now, Graham, the money, we've got the money situation, but the people who are coming from the old traditional unions into your union, what's the feedback like, and are they, you know, much more happier now that they've moved from one to the other?
Oh, look, a lot of them came over because of the mandate thing, so they're ecstatic that there's someone actually standing up for them, because the red unions, we are not anti-vaxxers. We're just opposed to the concept of mandatory anything, let alone vaccinations, which clearly have demonstrated that they might have worked originally, they don't work now.
I don't think they worked ever.
Argue that, but we know with no argument that they don't work now. and they're still doing. Anyway, the point I was making before, which is The LNP didn't understand the politics of this, because all the people that were affected by the actions of the Labor governments of the state in Victoria and Queensland in particular, they're all conservatives. Mm. And the conservatives just went walkabout. So they've got none of the upside, and there's going to be a lot of downsides of this as the truth comes out about what's been going on.
Correct.
And they'll share the downsides. I mean, how anyone could advise any political party to take that sort of action is just beyond me. I'd be lining up and sacking them or shooting them.
You go back to the fact that they haven't got a clue at any level of understanding of many. I did try to point some things out to a few conservative politicians. They weren't interested in listening, did not want to know about it, because, again, it meant a bit of hard work. And I think that's the first problem we run into with these turkeys.
Oh, well, the polling was against them. But now, you know, Pelletier's opened the place up. Mm. And she gets all the credit for that. It's crazy. They really just have no political nous at all.
But back to your union structure, you've got the nurses' union. Are you branching out into other areas?
We've got mainly nurses.
One at a time.
Yeah, mainly nurses and teachers. We took over, we amalgamated with the guy that had set up a bus drivers' union. So we've got, I think there's about 1,000 drivers there around Australia. So we've got nurses, teachers, drivers in general, transport, general workers,
trucking people, that sort of thing.
Yeah, trucking people. Right. We haven't really got into that yet, but we will. Independent Workers Union of Australia. Together, it didn't look like the AWU. That's doing well Australia-wide. We've set up AMPS, which is the Australian Medical Professionals Society, in opposition to the AMA. What's that one grow steadily.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's interesting though, because you know the AMA to me is just a left wing pile of crap, unfortunately, and the opportunity to move from what's always been there to another structure must be appealing. I would have thought to 30 or 40% of the employees in each area, maybe not all, but I thought it would be a fairly large number.
Yeah, because most union membership is not actually voluntary in the sense of going back to that 6%.
Yeah,
right? There's always an overarching factor. And you've got the union membership in Australia today, and we just did a bit of a rough count, went through every union in Queensland and worked out how many people would be conservatives. Because you get a bit of an idea. Nurses, it's probably a majority of nurses would be conservative, probably 50-55%. Teachers, probably 20% if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And we went through every one of the unions, and you did the numbers. They're just guesstimates, but union by union by union, and we knew which ones had EBAs and what. It's about 30-35% of every unionist in Australia votes non-Labor. Right. So, and look at the CFMEU. I mean, everyone says, "Oh, they're Labor through and through." These are guys making between $200,000 and $400,000 a year.
Mm.
Right? Half of them would vote. You know, they're voting for their pockets on their vote.
Yeah.
So there's a. These people, we think that we can pick these people up because we don't do any politics. I'm bemoaning the state of politics, but no money at all gets used for any party political purpose.
It's used for the benefit of the individual.
Yeah, we don't collect it. That's what you are. We don't collect it, so we can't misuse it. We're only collecting 60% of what they collect.
Yeah.
So we leave it in the pockets of the teachers and the nurses.
That's a rather admirable, unusual trait to be doing. I think that's very dangerous, doing the right thing by people.
Don't tell anybody.
Graham, can I just ask quickly, because we're going to run out of time pretty shortly, but can I just ask, the monies that you collect for the membership of your union, how effective can that be used as compared with the monies that's collected from the registered unions or in the registered union?
Well, to take the mandates... The mandates, I mean, none of the traditional unions did anything. So whatever we did, and we did a bloody wasn't quite $1 million worth, but I think we spent about $800,000 on legals, you know, for our small group. It was very effective. You know, we fight.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And we may be able to get some more from you just after the news break.